time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt joining us, and on the phone, the author of a wonderful new book that we absolutely loved called From the Dugouts to the Trenches, Baseball During the Great War. Jim Leake, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Fantastic book, and I like to think of myself as a big and fairly knowledgeable fan of baseball and as a history teacher, too, but I learned so much new information from reading this book. Tremendous research.
Well, thank you. I had a good time doing it.
Now, you've written on other baseball books. You've written a lot about the Civil War. I mean, and you've written both fiction and nonfiction. Of all the things you discovered in this book, what was the thing that most surprised you?
Most surprised me? Well, I think it was the fact that the American League teams in 1917 all had regular Army drill sergeants and ran them through drills during spring training and on into the season. I had never run across that before, so that was an interesting fact.
Yeah, and using baseball bats instead of rifles.
That's right. A lot of them just didn't have the Springfields yet, so they just made do with bats for quite a while.
Yeah,
that's the cover picture, the Washington Senators drilling with bats.
Yeah, one of the other things that struck me about this is, and I hadn't thought about this till at the recent Sport Literature Association conference, that really this is the time when it's not just we play sports so that we will have great leaders of war, but war will create great leaders for our sports when they come home. This seems to be sort of the divide in that in America. Am I out of my mind, or am I onto something there?
You may be onto something. I mean, athletes have always been held up as role models, unfairly, I think, but they have. And some of them rise to that level, and some don't. I can give you instances on both sides.
But it's interesting, too, coming fairly soon after a time when ballplayers were regarded as second-class citizens. Some of the finer hotels did not want ballplayers staying there when they were on the road. But during the Great War, they were expected to be role models and expected to do the right thing for the war effort.
They were, and I think some of them were unfairly criticized because certain sports writers and certain publications didn't like the role some of them had. A lot of the Boston Red Sox and Boston Braves players became Navy yeomen. And yeoman is essentially a clerical position. And for the Sporting News and some other publications, that just didn't do it. That wasn't good enough, and there was some sniping, even though these yeomen served honorably and well, and some of them overseas.
Interesting story involving a pitcher, Fred Tony. Can you share that story?
Fred Tony was the only ball player who was indicted. He was indicted for draft evasion and was tried a couple times and was not convicted, but he was convicted for violations of the Mann Act because he apparently had taken a teenage girl over state lines for what was deemed immoral purposes. So Fred Tony did spend some time in jail, though it didn't seem to affect his career much afterwards.
Well, speaking of people whose careers were affected, Christy Mathewson's career was certainly affected by his service in France, and maybe you could explain a little bit of that for our listeners.
Well, Christy Mathewson was the manager of the Cincinnati Reds in 1918, and after the season ended earlier, he and a number of other former ball players and current ball players ended up in what was called the Gas and Flame Division, the Chemical Warfare Service, essentially. And he and Ty Cobb both were commissioned, both were captains, and they were in a training accident in France very late in the war. This was a training exercise to acquaint soldiers with poison gas, and unbelievably, they were using real poison gas, and everyone missed the signal to put on their gas mask, and the gas was released, and there was this mad scramble, this pandemonium to get out of the room, and 8 soldiers died from that incident. Ty Cobb inhaled some of the gas and was affected for several weeks. Christy Mathewson inhaled more of it and was badly affected, and it likely contributed to his early death of tuberculosis.
We're talking with author Jim Leake here on Sports Lit 101 on Downtown. Another player who suffered from the effects of what he did in World War One, the great Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Yes, Alex went overseas in an artillery battery. He was in the 342nd Field Artillery, and that group was in combat firing literally until the last minute of the war. He came back. He was somewhat deafened. He was somewhat injured. He was somewhat affected by the war itself. And one of the Sabre biographers said that he thought the Great War had badly damaged two of the great pitchers of the era, Christy Mathewson and Grover Cleveland Alexander.
You also point out in the book, Jim, that in later years, players excused for deferments of any kind were often really picked upon. Mickey Mantle being one of them, called commie and this and that. Is the roots of that in bad journalism, or the roots of it in some kind of populism that we don't really understand today?
I think it's probably the latter. You know, that they were held up as role models, and if they weren't in combat, you know, killing the enemy right and left, they were somehow not living up to the ideal. And during World War One, a number of major league ball players ended up taking deferments in essential industries that supported the war. There was a government worker fight order, which meant everyone of draft age either had to be in the armed forces or had to be working in an essential industry. So a number of ball players worked for shipyards and steel mills and played on the company teams. And the word slackers was thrown about quite a bit, somewhat unfairly or entirely unfairly, perhaps, because it was entirely legal. What they were doing was a needed employment. They were building ships, they were making steel, and they were playing ball on the weekends. But in the public opinion and to a number of sports writers and sports publications, that just wasn't good enough.
I was fascinated to read the story of the 1918 World Series. It holds such a special place in the hearts of New Englanders because for so many, 86 years, it was the last World Championship for the Boston Red Sox. But that Red Sox team had managed to keep most of its most important stars out of the military and then got in the middle of a big argument about where the games would be played, how much money the players would get, and it was a World Series, as you write, that the fans were pretty disinterested in.
Yeah, there wasn't great attendance for the series either in Chicago or in Boston, and Major League Baseball had unilaterally really cut the payout, the World Series payout, to the two teams. And when they got to Boston, the players threatened to strike. They delayed taking the field for an hour while there were negotiations going on. You know, and to some extent, they had a legitimate argument. But in the court of public opinion, they had no argument whatever. And, you know, there were soldiers and sailors and wounded soldiers and sailors waiting in the stands. So, as we would say today, the optics were just terrible. And the players publicly just didn't, they had no case at all. And in the end, they caved and played the game.
You mentioned public perception. Do you think that Colonel Rupert and Charles Comiskey were in any way doing what they did to advance the cause of the training their troops solely to gain, or not solely, but in some way to gain public acclaim? Or was it really a deep down with them a commitment?
I think with some of them, Comiskey and the Yankees, you know, the co-owner was T.L. Huston, and yeah, he was overseas in the service. I think to a great extent, for some of them, it was really a patriotic duty. But, of course, they were also good businessmen. And as one of the sports writers said, could you imagine Charles Comiskey not taking this stand? You know, it was simply good business as well.
baseball went on in many ways, but it was a very different baseball. And I was interested to read that most of the minor leagues just completely shut down during the war years.
They did. World War One just almost killed the minor leagues. There were 22 minor leagues at all levels going into the 17th season. Only five managed to finish that season, and only one managed to finish the 1918 season. That was what was called the New International League, which had almost folded before the season began and ended up dropping some teams and combining with the New York State League. So the war just decimated the minor leagues.
Do you think that as we look back on baseball and how it became, for a long time was the biggest game, it was the game, that something has been lost in the fact that it's become a game people are more likely to see on TV than in person?
Oh, boy, that's really beyond my scope, I think. But there's so much competition. There's so much more competition in everything today than there was 100 years ago. It was probably inevitable that baseball's star would fade somewhat.
Well, and because of the role that baseball played in America at the time, it set some precedents as well, including the precedent that was established during the war of singing and honoring the country with the Star-Spangled Banner.
That's right. The Star-Spangled Banner wasn't yet the national anthem. That wasn't until 1931, but it had been played and sung at ball games as early as the Civil War, but not consistently. During the war, it was sung and played occasionally, but during the 1918 World Series in Chicago, a band struck it up during the seventh inning stretch. And the Red Sox third baseman, a guy named Thomas, Fred Thomas, Thompson, I'm sorry, was on leave from the Navy. He was at the Great Lakes, and he had leave to play in the game. And when they struck up the Star-Spangled Banner, the other players took off their caps, of course, and faced the flag. He, being in the service, kept his cap on and saluted. And the crowd noticed and sort of went crazy and began applauding, and they were singing. And from then on, the Star-Spangled Banner was played at all opening days and World Series games, and was played at every game beginning in World War II. So you can start that. You can attribute that to Fred Thomas, I think. He was the tipping point. Fred Thomas, third baseman, on a leave from the Navy.
There are so many heroic figures in the book. Hank Gowdy comes to mind. From your perspective, who was the player that you were most taken with in his story?
I really liked Hank Gowdy, the first active major leaguer to enlist. He's from my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, so that was part of it. The stories that really struck me, though, were Eddie Grant, the major leaguer who was killed, and his former teammate and fellow officer, Moose McCormick, who came back shell-shocked. You know, they had played together, they had trained together, they went to separate divisions, and they had different fates in the war. And that story really struck me.
I was wondering how much your inspiration for doing this was curiosity, and how much of it had to do with the fact that you served in the Navy, and that you have a great eye for history in other ways. Did you look at this more as a historical, a book of historical research, or more of a book of discovery?
Boy, that's a good question. Maybe more of discovery. I mean, really, this book traces back 7 or 8 years when I found a compiled edition of the Stars and Stripes, the great Army newspaper published in Paris, and was looking through that and realized what a great sports section it had, in part because Grantland Rice was the sports editor for a while. And I began reading those stories, and when I went through all of those, I began looking for similar stories in the American daily newspapers, and it just went from there. It's one of those deals where you tug the little loose thread and find this whole amazing tapestry that you didn't know.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and I'm looking forward to, I'm going to contact the press. I want to get your book about the 1918 baseball game in England for the King, and we'll get a chance to talk again, I hope.
Great. I'd like that.
Thank you very much. Jim Leake, the author of From the Dugouts to the Trenches, here on Sports Lit 101.